Greetings and plutonic stipulations, my micrometrically fantastic listeners, and welcome to this August 2015 Science News Update. I'm your host for this blubberously sonorous science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. I again thank my listeners for their concern over my sleep apnea. Over July, I continued to have you guys email me about your thoughts on how I should deal with it. One of our listeners, Michael Philippus, was especially worried. He thinks that I'm being quite inane about a serious disease, and I should be taking it much more seriously as a threat than I am. Thank you, Michael. Thank you for your disquiet about my mental state. I'm going to my doctor for a checkup in the next 2 weeks, and I will make my concerns very clear to him. However, you must understand that my humor is a bit of a defense mechanism. If I had cancer or heart disease or mad cow disease or the dropsies for that matter, I would still be inane about it and not take it very seriously. We're all going to die of something, and it doesn't really matter what hideousness befalls us in the end, does it? Especially since we have no control over that. So why worry about it? It's in the hands of God as far as I'm concerned. The sad, laughable irony is that my lovely wife and kids will tell you this, that even though life-threatening diseases are not high on my worry list, I instead go bonkers over stupid, unimportant things like who left the full bottle of milk out on the counter for hours, or why there's an entire Lego set in pieces on the floor of my dining room, or who put the 2-foot-long scratch in my minivan. But the upshot, Michael, is that the more serious the disease is, if I'm likely to get it, the less serious I'm really going to be about it. That's just me. I don't know about other people. But let's start the evening's news story with a world record in science. I love world records. A study published August 17th in the journal Nature provides multiple lines of evidence, actually, that pressurized hydrogen sulfide is so far the highest temperature superconductor ever discovered. Dr. Mikhail Eremets of the Max Planck Institute for Chemistry made the information public back in June on archive.com, but his group submitted the work to a real peer-reviewed journal to examine their data right afterwards. And the work shows that pressurized hydrogen sulfide is a superconductor at roughly 200 Kelvin. Now, for non-scientists out there, that's about minus 73 degrees Celsius, or about minus 100 Fahrenheit if you live in the US or England. If confirmed, the discovery would nudge physicists closer to their ultimate goal of a room temperature superconductor, which is about 300 Kelvin. No other known material is superconducting so far above 164 Kelvin. Eremets and his colleagues crushed hydrogen sulfide samples between diamonds at more than a million times standard atmospheric pressure. The researchers report that at temperatures as high as 203 Kelvin, the samples expelled magnetic fields, exhibiting something called the Meissner effect. This magnetic evidence is allegedly a stronger indicator of superconducting than the electrical resistance measurements that the team originally used to make their case back in June. Now, the whole thing is already becoming quite controversial. Lots of scientists are screaming to see if a separate group of physicists can replicate the finding. I guess they're worried about something like cold fusion and that controversy coming about. Many think it's still too early to uncork the champagne, but confirmation could take time because there aren't exactly a whole bunch of labs out there that can perform the precision measurements at pressures of more than a million times what you find anywhere on the face of the earth. Eremets says, quote, "If we understand the structure of these compounds under pressure, that could enable physicists to devise materials that seamlessly shuttle electrons at more reasonable pressures and temperatures." And the hilarious, ironic thing, and it may be obvious, is the idea that we finally found a superconductor that can function at a fairly low temperature, or a fairly high temperature, I should say, which has been the physics holy grail for years, but it only works under the most absurdly high pressures possible that you can't exactly use to run your desktop PC. Next story, another record. Well, I guess it depends on how you define what a record is. NASA scientists have discovered a planet more similar to Earth than any other yet documented. Kepler 452b, as it's called, is 60% larger than our planet and has a year that's approximately 385 days long. Nice. I'm ready to move. I'd already be younger if I was living there by two whole years. Anyway, Dr. John Jenkins of the Kepler Project's data analysis team told reporters at a news conference July 23rd, quote, "Today the Earth is a little less lonely because there's a new kid on the block," unquote. Okay. Jenkins, that's a fairly silly statement. The Earth has never been very lonely, and a slightly larger planet 1,400 light-years away is not going to resolve that loneliness by very much. But let's just go with it. Kepler 452b is in the Cygnus constellation, and its sun, Kepler 452, is pretty similar to our own, with the same temperature, the diameter just about 10% larger. Kepler 452b is estimated to be 5 times as dense as Earth, with about twice the gravity. So alien soldiers from there will be pretty darn strong when they get here. Okay, I'm joking, obviously, but there's actually a pretty good chance that something is alive on that planet, because it is way older than Earth. Jenkins says, quote, "It's awe-inspiring to consider that this planet has spent 6 billion years longer in the habitable zone of its star than Earth. That substantial opportunity for life to arise, should all the necessary ingredients and conditions for life exist on that planet," unquote. Jenkins finishes with, quote, "Because of its size and distance, it is unlikely we will ever find out more about Kepler 452b for a considerable time, if ever," unquote. Not exactly a sanguine guy, but I guess Piers Anthony was right. We need a macroscope, or we will never exactly see what's out there. Next story. Well, even without a macroscope, we are certainly living in the future. Here's another story that brings that home. A few years ago, I wrote a genre novel called The Standards of Creation, in which one of the main conceits was the idea of taking the biochemical pathway for making an opiate and transferring that entire pathway into an entirely different plant species, such as wheat or corn. When I wrote about putting an entire transgenetic pathway into a new organism 10 or 12 years ago, it was still kind of speculative. Well, science has caught up with me. Dr. Christina Smolk and her research group from Stanford University have engineered yeast to make sugar into a chemical called thebaine, which is a precursor to opiates like morphine. The work brings together the beginnings of the pathway and the central stages of the pathway into a single strain of yeast, which has never existed before. And the researchers published their findings August 13th in the journal Science. Making yeast that can eventually produce an opiate required enzymes from mammals, plants, bacteria, and a few from the yeast itself. The result is a proof of concept that yeast can take in sugar and ferment it into opiates and other drugs with the goal of using them for research into new pharmaceuticals. Smolk estimates that the full pathway from sugar to morphine would require a 7 million-fold improvement in yield before it can put a poppy out of business. And I find that very interesting because opiate yield was precisely the problem that the fictional protagonist in my novel had when he was working on the same problem. By the way, you didn't think you'd get away without a plug from me, did you? The Standards of Creation is still only in audio form, narrated by yours truly, and one of these days I'll get around to PDF formatting it for actual hard copy publication on Amazon, or I guess you call it actually ebook publication on Amazon. However, it can be purchased on uvulaaudio.com for the cool price of 99 cents for almost 20 hours of audio, If you're curious about it, take a listen to the free preview, which is available. It can be purchased through the protected PayPal link on the page. And again, that was uvulaaudio.com, uvulaaudio.com. All right, onwards and upwards. So if someone is being generous, do they have an ulterior motive? Can doing a good deed mean more than simply the good deed itself? Humans have an enormous capacity for generosity. We give money to the homeless in need of shelter, to distant strangers in times of catastrophe. We even give indirectly by donating money to friends and colleagues, fundraising for charities. But why do we give? And how much are we actually willing to part with? The July issue of the journal Current Biology, Doctors Nicola Raihani and Sarah Jane Smith of University College London examine these questions. It's not surprising at all that the answer to, well, all the questions pretty much comes down to sex and genetic selection. Every year, athletes raise money for charity by actually finishing the London Marathon. After picking a charity, runners annoy everyone they know to pledge money that is paid out following the race completion, and the marathon makes millions. But it also provided Raihani and Smith with an opportunity to study patterns of human generosity, because all the donations are online and they're completely public. So they were able to study who made the donations and to whom. Each donation page has a photo of the runner and then a list of the money given by each donor. So the donors know the recipients, and crucially, they can also see what the previous person gave. And it turns out that this context matters a great deal. The authors found that when following an average donor, individuals in turn contributed the average amount. However, when the previous donor gave an especially large donation, this triggered a response known as competitive helping, which results in the second donor outgiving the first. However, here is the kicker. The competitive helping was gender specific. While donations from females were unaffected by the gender of earlier donors, men gave more if the previous large donor was a male. More interesting, and kind of sad, the extent of competitive helping among men was entirely dependent on the attractiveness of the runner herself. In practical terms, this amounted to about 30 pounds more per donation. In short, the researchers found that men compete with each other for the perceived recognition of attractive female fundraisers, and the manner in which this is done is by flaunting their cash. Humans are not alone in using social cues to adjust their behavior. Males vying for access to females use all manner of exaggerated displays to convince potential mates of their suitability, and the extent of their signaling increases with an audience. Think of peacocks or the mating dances of the birds of paradise. But this study clarifies that for humans, males work harder to beat each other when their perceived mate is a more attractive catch. At the same time, the men are using fairly honest signals of their own quality. If you think about it, I mean, not only do the men in these fundraising games provide direct evidence of their wealth, and that's a quality that's hard to fake, but they also hint at their generous, good-hearted tendencies. And hey, who doesn't want a mate that's rich and generous? But is this actually generosity, or is it simply a mating dance showing how lovely your plumage is? True generosity is entirely selfless. And is it any less so if it's tainted with cryptically selfish and largely unconscious motivations? Well, I say yes, it is. I mean, true generosity, you expect nothing back. And here, these men, whether consciously or unconsciously, are showing off in hopes of getting some noogie, or even a long-term mate. The follow-up to this study will be to see how successful the men were in their plumage dances. Raihani and Smith intend to seek to identify the consequences for these competitive helpers. In the end, do they get the girl? Do the fundraisers run straight from the marathon into the arms of their donors? Probably not, but we'll have to wait until the sponsorships from the next London Marathon are in to probably find out. So that comment about male sexists naturally leads into a story about whether male sexists will go the way of all flesh, so to speak, and disappear from the scene. And that appears not to be quite the case quite yet. I have commented previously that the Y chromosome in mammalian males, not just humans, is not going to disappear as soon as some scientists predicted a decade or two ago, when it was suggested that the male selecting chromosome is slowly fading away because it is a fragile thing and not needed. Well, the Y chromosome has been fading as genes disappeared from it over millions of years. But where did they go? That's been the question that's really arisen more recently. In the May issue of the journal Genome Biology, Dr. Jennifer Hughes of the MIT Whitehead Institute suggests one scenario and what may be happening. Over the past few hundred million years, the mammalian Y chromosome has lost hundreds of genes. That loss has puzzled scientists. Many of those genes were not sex-specific, per se, but instead contributed to broad and important cellular functions. Hughes says, quote, "We know that the Y chromosome started as a normal chromosome. In fact, the X and Y used to be identical, if you go back 300 million years in time. But if you look at the Y today, you see it's very small in size compared to the X. It started with over 600 genes and now has less than 100. We wanted to understand why that happened, and whether the Y chromosome was set to continue down that path, and perhaps, as some have suggested, disappear altogether," unquote. So back in 2012, I conveyed a story on this podcast from the Hughes Lab, telling how she had discovered that the human male doesn't have to worry about the loss of the Y chromosome. It's only lost a single gene in the past 25 million years. This suggests that the remaining genes have been preserved because they are serving important functions. In the last 3 years, Hughes and her colleagues decided to take a deeper look at the Y chromosome. They used computational analysis of publicly available genomic sequences from a number of mammalian species, including marsupials, apes, rodents, and cattle. In doing that, they found 8 cases of key genes that had relocated to non-sex chromosomes when the corresponding Y-linked gene was lost. Hughes comments, quote, "This is reminiscent of a phenomenon that we've seen in a funny species of rat that only lives in Japan. This species has lost its Y chromosome altogether, and that's because many of the important genes that were on the Y chromosome relocated to autosomes, non-sex chromosomes. So what was thought to be a single isolated quirk of one species may be more widespread, and another way that the Y chromosome can cope with losing genes," unquote. Hughes argues that these findings confirm the importance of the Y chromosome genes. She says, quote, "The Y chromosome is certainly not going anywhere. The genes that have been conserved on the Y chromosome perform functions important enough that they've been preserved for hundreds of millions of years. And in the cases where it looks like a gene may have disappeared, we found it may not have. It just found a new home elsewhere, confirming the importance of the Y chromosome, not just for males, but perhaps for the entire biology of the human species," unquote. The lesson here? Just because some genetic component looks like it has disappeared, it ain't necessarily so. The next story is a major breakthrough, a bit scary, but a major breakthrough. It's a leap forward in synthetic biology. You may or may not remember this little bit of cell biology. If you don't, the part of the cell that makes proteins is called the ribosome. It's literally the microscopic anvil upon which all of Earth biology is based, since without it, cells would be unable to function and make no proteins. Scientists at the University of Illinois at Chicago and Northwestern say that they have engineered a tethered ribosome that works nearly as well as the authentic organelle that produces all the proteins and enzymes within the cell. The engineered ribosome may enable the production of new drugs and the next generation of biomaterials, and lead to a better understanding of how ribosomes function, according to the researchers. The artificial ribosome, called a ribo-T, was created in the laboratory of Dr. Alexander Mankin and Dr. Michael Jewett. This human-made ribosome may be able to be manipulated in the laboratory to do things that natural ribosomes can't. When the cell makes a protein, a messenger RNA is copied from DNA. The ribosome's two subunits, a large and a small one, unite onto the mRNA to form a functional unit that assembles the protein. Again, kind of like a nano-sized anvil. Once the protein molecule is complete, the ribosome subunits, both of which are themselves made up of RNA and protein, separate from each other. In a new study in the journal Nature, the researchers described the design and properties of the artificial ribo-T, which has subunits that don't separate. Ribo-T may be able to be tuned to produce unique and functional polymers for exploring ribosome functions or producing designer therapeutics and drugs and maybe even one day non-biological polymers. Mankin says, quote, "We felt like there was a very small chance ribo-T could work, but we did not really know, so we tried it anyway. And who knew?" Unquote. Yeah, I guess, who knew? So the last story of the night just goes to show that even in a very old branch of science, where we thought we knew everything, there are always surprises. Cytology is a branch of biology which is the equivalent of anatomy in large animals. It's the science which examines microanatomy of a cell, essentially, and examines how a cell divides and moves, etc. Organelles are the structures in complex cells which do many of the important jobs that cells need to stay alive. Things like the nucleus, which protects the DNA of the cell, or the lysosome, which is a combination recycling center and garbage dump. All the organelles have a job, and cells have been stared at since the late 1600s under microscopes. So it was thought that there was pretty much nothing new under the sun that you could see in terms of structure. There were no more organelles to be found. They had all been accounted for. Well, in an event that is the biological equivalent of finding a new heart or lung or kidney in the human body, a new cellular organelle has been found. Well, you may not be excited about it, but I am because I get to teach about an additional structure in my cell biology classes. Wahoo! Something new to confuse my poor pupils. But the structure is called the mesh. It's a terrible name, by the way, but it's actually quite descriptive. 4 years ago, Dr. Stephen Royal, a researcher at the University of Warwick in Coventry, in the UK, obviously, and his team regularly used 2D electron microscopy to study mitosis, the process of cell division. They had a particular interest in the mitotic spindle. That's a tiny network of fibers in the cell that's responsible for accurately separating chromosomes into daughter cells during cell division, when the cells split apart and copy themselves. The spindle is made up of an array of proteins, including microtubules, that bundle together in groups of about 20 to 40 to form something called the kinetochore fibers. And these fibers generate the force needed to pull the chromosomes into the newly forming daughter cells. More than 40 years ago, electron microscopists first noticed an electron density between the microtubules in the kinetochore fibers. In other words, it seemed like there was something thicker there, or there seemed to be something there between those individual microtubules. And over time, and with improving technology, scientists have found that this increase in density between the fibers represented a 5 nanometer thick bridge stretching from about 6 to 20 nanometers to connect microtubules together. Royal says, quote, "We could tell that some bridges were crooked and that there were lots of different shapes of bridges. We wanted to see how the bridges looked in 3 dimensions." And that simple goal led Royal to introduce a new technology into his laboratory, which is 3D microscopy. Ultimately, he was able to discover this new cellular structure. Royal eventually found that these intermicrotubule bridges were not simple struts connecting two adjacent microtubules together, but instead were interconnected, with each contacting multiple microtubules within the kinetochore fiber to form a sort of net-like support system around the microtubules and the fibers. The early images that Royal has generated have toppled cell biologists' view of the so-called bridges connecting microtubules, and instead, they found this new cellular structure, this net-like mesh, to be something they have never seen before. Royal's team developed a semi-automated segmentation method for their 3D model building and held extensive discussions with colleagues at their university to develop 3D spatial statistics. They also collected tomograms in areas without microtubules to confirm that the connecting structures didn't exist in those areas. They logged the position of all the microtubules in three dimensions and measured the volume and number of contacts and locations of all the attachments. And the more images they collected, the more their confidence has grown that they have in fact found a new cellular structure, which they call the mesh. So how important is this new structure? Yeah, it's obviously important because it holds the microtubules in place, but so what? Well, Royal suggests that when the mesh does not work correctly, cellular problems will arise with reproduction of cells. Royal says, quote, "Work from several laboratories suggests that kinetochore fiber stability is important for accurate chromosome segregation. Too little or too much stability makes mitosis and cell division become inefficient. This could lead to chromosome missegregation, which is something seen in many solid tumors. Our idea is that the mesh is holding microtubules together in the kinetochore fiber and stabilizing them," unquote. He further goes on to say that they've looked at the changes in mesh composition and that those changes can result in mitotic problems. And that gives them two options. He says, first, we can think of ways to correct mesh composition in cells to stop them from making mistakes in mitosis and becoming cancerous. Or second, they might be able to target the mesh with drugs to prevent cells from dividing at all. Since the mesh is specific to mitotic microtubules, this approach would get around the terrible side effects that microtubule poisons, such as the taxanes, that are used to treat several cancer types. What do I say to all this? Well, I say, c'est la vie. I guess you never can tell. Well, that's all for me for now. As always, take care. Keep your thoughts pure when you donate to those cute runners. Start petitioning Congress to fund that macroscope. And I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.